Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. Welcome to our new time, earlier in the day, so that more of you can be with us. And thanks to Doug and Dan at BBS Radio for enabling the switch. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal empowerment. If you have a question or insight, call us direct and toll-free at 1-888-268-4313 or call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show is up and can be found on BBS Radio site and at thespiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. This show and all past shows are available now on the station archives. Just yesterday, in the line at the grocery store, I ran into an old friend who asked about the show and challenged me on the name, The Spiritual Politician. She told me that politics was too dirty to be mixed with spiritual pursuits. Like I said, she's an old friend. I met her when I was active in an organization called the Amaranth. She's now around 89 or so, though she refuses to admit her age. I asked her how she felt about what she sees government and politicians do. She had a lot to say about that. When she'd worked her way through the tribulations of Monica and calmed down just a little bit, I asked her how she felt about enabling and subsidizing that kind of behavior. She's a person who always does pay all of her taxes. She didn't like to say anything. I could see what she thought, though. We talked for a while. Eventually, she agreed that Jesus wants all of us in all parts of our lives to reflect him. I think she was a little troubled, but I know she's an honest person who will think about that contradiction in how we live and what we accept as government. Think about the question the spiritual politician raises. Why is our political system so out of sync with the way most of us believe we should really see others? Why do we use a system that makes doing the right thing an act of heroism instead of something we just take for granted? The team mentality of politics in America has stolen from all of us the certainty we should have about the things that matter most, things like justice, honor, and our very rights as people. Politics has become a game, one that all decent people lose. Political parties use the strategies and tactics of war on each other and on us as Americans. All Americans need to look at politics through this new lens. America started with the idea that all of us are inherently equal and free. And that's a core truth. We are free to choose, free to live, to breathe, to work, and to live our lives as each of us sees fit. Government does not own us. Government is just a contractor we trusted to perform some services on our behalf. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we remind you that contractors can be fired and held accountable. No government or politician has sovereign immunity, no matter how they dance around and insist that they do. The monarchical trappings they clutch are the emperor's new clothes, and underneath they are as naked as babes just born, but without the innocence. Our guest this evening, Good Friday, has an interesting story to share with us. Dane R. is the brother of an American hero of conscience, Ron Ridenour. Ron, for those of you who are too young to remember the Vietnam conflict, was the 22-year-old man who wrote the letter to Congress that resulted in the investigation into what we all know now as the My Lai Massacre. It was 1969, and he was a whistleblower who was both praised and blamed. Ridenour went on from there to become an investigative journalist of note, and every year The Nation magazine gives an award in his memory to other whistleblowers. Dane R., his younger brother, has spent a lifetime doing good in his own right, and he will be telling us about that and about his own campaign to ensure his brother's legacy is remembered. Dane, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to our show.
Well, thank you, Melinda.
It's so nice to have you with us, especially on Good Friday. Now,
well, good. It's a good time.
Yes. Now, I always like to start by having our guest tell us something about himself. And so what is it that you think that we should know about you that's going to give us a sense of who you are?
Well, that would be a hard thing, I guess, to do on the radio. I can't offer you any books or articles that I've got that you can publish or see. What I would like to do is I'd like to say that I have, I shared with Ron an awareness that began with the My Lai incident. And from that time forward, we were sort of, I mean, I couldn't meet people after that and tell them who I was and not have them want to share with stories about things that they'd seen and heard that were not right to them. I think that there's a lot of whistleblowers out there if they had the chance. There just aren't very many investigative reporters that they trust.
Well, actually, Ron didn't. There was no investigative reporter who asked him to write the letter. It was something he just, he proactively did it, right?
He did that as a citizen. He had gone to Vietnam, idealistic like many of these people do, and discovered that his idealism was really misplaced, and realized, after been there for a while, that they weren't the good guys, and that no matter how they tried to, you know, tell themselves, because they could, most of the guys were over there thinking they were the good guys. When they got there, they discovered that they weren't really rooted that way, and you know, honest review of what they were doing there didn't give them much encouragement to feel good about it. So,
was Ron actually at My Lai?
No, Ron. That's an interesting story. It's probably more interesting because he wasn't there than because he was. Because Ron was a LRP, long-range reconnaissance patrol guy, after he'd been there about 6 months. He spent the first 6 months as a door gunner. If you wanted out of an assignment at that time in Vietnam, and to go to a worse assignment, he was a door gunner. And there weren't very many worse jobs.
Except maybe forward observer, right?
Huh? Yeah, well, that's what he was, basically.
Yeah.
And while he was there, other guys had transferred in, and a lot of these guys were guys who transferred from the My Lai unit, Company B, that had served in My Lai under Barker. And the reason for that was, of course, that they could only go to a worse place, too, if they wanted out. And they ended up the same place. It turns out that Ron knew a lot of these people because he trained with them at Schofield Barracks in Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
And they'd all gone to Vietnam as replacements. And when they started, you know, after they'd been there about 6 months and started transferring away from those assignments, they sort of, there was like a reunion of them at this long-range reconnaissance unit. The thing about long-range reconnaissance unit is you spend a lot of time with your buddies. You spend 3 days in the field being quiet, or maybe 4 or 5 days in the field being quiet, and then when you come back, you get, you know, a week or so before you have to go back out. So they got to know each other really well and shared their stories, and that's how he found out about My Lai.
When had he actually, he enlisted, right? He wasn't drafted.
He was drafted.
Oh, he was drafted. But what year was that?
1967.
So it's 1967, so he'd been in a couple years before he actually wrote the letter. Was he still in the military?
No, he
wrote the letter.
He got out of the military and wrote the letter within a few weeks.
But he did wait until he had actually separated from the military to write the letter.
That's right.
And that was that intentional?
Absolutely.
Because he didn't feel while he was still, you know, wearing the uniform, he could report that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely not.
But after he had gotten out, he felt it was his duty as a citizen to speak out.
That's right.
Well, you must have had some really interesting conversations. Was he home when he made that decision? Was he, did he come back? And you were, now where were you living when this happened?
When he sent that letter, I was living in just south of the Imjin Bridge in South Korea. I was in South Korea from April of 68 until May of 69.
Well, what were you doing in Korea? Were you in the military?
Well, yes, I was in the military. In fact, Ron had given me the heads up that he was going to Vietnam, and I volunteered for the draft right after that so that I could have a better chance of not going to Vietnam. And in fact, that did make the difference, because I did get orders for Vietnam, and I had them changed.
And that's because you were two brothers, and you would both be brothers in a...
Right, sole surviving son exemption.
I see, okay. So that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Ron was... He was a person who really watched out for his family. He, at the same time, he expressed his anger most easily with his family. But he was extremely protective, and he was protective of all the people around him. And that's why he was able to actually write that letter and have it make a difference. And the reason for this is really simple.
How old were you then when you were in Vietnam?
I was 21.
You were 21, so you're just a year apart?
We're 14 months apart.
Okay. That's about
22 months apart, I'm sorry, 22 months.
Okay, you're 22 months apart.
22 months apart, yeah.
And was he had been living, had you been living all in the family home when he was drafted, when he was drafted?
No, that's another interesting story. Ron had he was a big kid at 14. My stepfather asked him to quit school and help in the family business because he'd taken a big contract that he felt that he couldn't do without family help. So Ron took his freshman year out of school and helped in the family business.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went back to school and was, you know, trying to catch up with his class. And his senior year, my stepdad, after his junior year, my stepdad asked him to drop out of school again. And he left home and took a job at a gas station and lived in a rented room so he could finish high school. After that, he got a bit of a scholarship to play football at Phoenix College and was interested in doing that. But he, in order to work and go to school, he had to take just 12 hours, which wasn't sufficient to get a draft exemption, and so he got drafted.
Ah.
And
that was 67.
Must have been, yeah. The fall, spring of 67. Yeah.
But you were still seeing a lot of your brother then, right? And you were living in Phoenix?
Yeah, we were living at the family home in Glendale, 43rd Avenue. You know, sure, I saw him at school. I saw him, he only worked about a mile away at a gas station. We visited all the time, you know. After that, moved in with my sister. She moved out of the family home and got a little house, and she and him lived together for several years until this thing all unfolded.
The family was always close, it sounds like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ron was, in high school, for instance, there was an event, not an event, he got into a fight in high school. And it was one of those things, it was a kind of a big deal in school because he had, every school has new people writing, and sometimes the new people are notable. This fellow that Ron got in a fight with was 6'7", about 260 pounds, looked like a Greek god, and he was a bully. And it wasn't a big deal. I mean, you know, he's a 17-year-old kid. And but he pushed on one of my brother's friends who was in line with him in PE, and they had a fight. He basically called him out on it and hit him in the face, which is a bad deal because this kid had a pretty face because he had an accident and had to have a lot of cosmetic surgery. So they didn't want him to get hit in the face.
Uh-huh. But he should have been more careful about who he picked.
Yeah, he should have been more careful about that. But he didn't hurt him, really. It was mostly a big deal. But it was just typical of the kind of things that Ron did on a normal basis in terms of standing up for the people around him when, you know, they were outclassed, outsized. And that's really why this happened, why Meet Lai happened. It's why he became an investigative reporter. It's why he was not well respected by the media.
Now, why is that? Because,
well,
because
the media is owned. It's owned. And they only make money if they sell advertising. And if you don't pull any punches about powerful people, you will offend them. And they will apply pressure to the newspaper.
Uh-huh. Let's go back a minute, because this brings up an interesting point. Ron wrote the letter. How long was it before he got a response?
Oh, that's an interesting question because, you know, he sent out, it's interesting because, well, first of all, he sent out a legal size letter. It was 3 pages. It was mimeographed, and it was not double-spaced. It's not the type of thing normally that gets any attraction whatsoever in Washington, D.C. I mean, they just don't, they throw those things away. And
exactly who did he send it to?
He sent it to the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Army. He sent it to the President, the Vice President, the heads of all the committees in Congress that had...
Very thorough.
Yeah, well, right, he sent it off to all of them. And mostly just, you know, people who had a need to know. There were no versions of it that went out to the press. There was no press contact by Ron. In fact, the only time the press got hold of this is when somebody in the Pentagon called Seymour Hersh and gave him a heads up that William Calley was about to be prosecuted or charged, or actually that he had just been put on, what do you call that?
Suspended.
They wouldn't let him get out. Lieutenant Calley was about to be discharged, and because of this investigation, they put a hold on his discharge. And at that point, that's when the word went out, and Seymour Hersh got on the deal. And he's a great guy, and he did everything right. You know, Ron wasn't a writer at that time. He was just a student. I mean, later on, when Ron was actually being a reporter, investigative reporter, Hersh would often comment that it should have been, you know, that he'd done all the work. Ron had done everything. All the Seymour Hersh could do was report it, you know, after it had been basically handed to him.
Now, we are now 30 years removed almost from these events. So just for a moment.
We are 30 years removed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's go back and take a look at what Meet Lai was about. Would you like to tell the audience about what happened there?
Well, I can tell them pretty much. I probably remember it as well as anybody at this point, for somebody who wasn't there. As I understand it, these gentlemen, this unit, Company B, was part of a battalion. The other parts of the battalion were basically executing a pincers movement, and Company B went in to the hamlet, and the company had been given orders before they went in that there were no civilian, that there were no non-combatants, were no non-combatants in the village. I stress, no non-combatants.
So anybody there was fair game?
They were basically being given coded instructions that they were to kill everybody in the village. You know, there are no non-combatants. You know, what does that mean? You know, and even, it was just a bizarre thing. And these guys had been walking around in that area, which is basically a delta area. It's all very low, flat, wet, damp. They had a lot of punji steaks, a lot of mines and stuff that they had encountered. These are things that they absolutely, that were in the trail. I mean, the villagers used the trail. The villagers knew where they were. You couldn't use the trail if you didn't, you know. There was no real sympathy from these soldiers for these villagers. They were, in their practical sense, out to go men. But then that's, you know, we were invaders. So hard to, you know, it's hard to fault them for not wanting us there.
Yes.
But, you know, but the guys, it's hard to fault them for, you know, not being, you know, real sympathetic to these people's civilian status. The point of this is that it had nothing to do with how those soldiers felt, okay? It had to do with the army deciding that they were going to punish this village for supplying and support a Viet Cong regiment. And you have to understand about Vietnam and about the Viet Cong is that the Viet Cong were recruited from specific villages. If you had a, if you knew a Viet Cong unit's name, basically, you would know what village was supporting it. And
so this was very much a civil war.
Well, but I mean that's this is typically the way that armies are raised. Anyway, I mean, you know, that's how it works, except the United States. But even in the United States, we have a similar type of thing with Selective Service. They were instructed, basically, to wipe this village out as a message. And this is what Ron told me in 1997. He thought about it most of his life, and that he had decided at that point, this is in November of 1997, that he was convinced that he could go to the records center, having to do with the Vietnam War and with those units that were defending Saigon when Tet offensive struck. He could go to this the records of that unit, and he could find he could find records of what villages had been assaulted, all the records of what had happened, all the battle statistics. And he felt that if there was, if he was right, and his basic theory about My Lai at that point, you know, 30 years later, was that the My Lai had been done on purpose as a message to the Vietnamese civilians, or to the Viet Cong, that the gloves were off, that they could not expect to attack Saigon and not be attacked at home. Basically, that was a message. You come into our house and attack us, well, guess what? We're coming in your house and attacking you. My Lai may have been the only one. It may have been the first one.
But
I doubt it.
But you don't know, and nobody's ever done any investigation.
No, Ron died 6 months later.
Never got
a chance to do that.
Mm-hmm. So that's actually some research that remains to be done.
I would assume, yeah. I mean, My Lai is an interesting case. I mean, it's a huge deal in military history. the likelihood of having that kind of thing come out is, it's just not, it's very hard to get something like that to come out. And the only reason it came out is because Ron was enough of a leader that he was an inspiration to the people around him, and that when people found out that Ron was seriously going to take this on, was going to do what he could to make it right and report it and see that it didn't go unpunished, they stepped up. And, you know, the guys who stepped up for that, they didn't do it just because they hated the Army, but because they trusted that Ron would do the right thing.
And the right thing meant a lot.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it meant a lot. I mean, you know, these guys, I mean, think about this guy in Pennsylvania, the first one to go and, they go to him and they say, did this really happen? You know, I mean, how easy would it have been for him to say, no, man, you're crazy. I didn't see nothing. You know, it would have been over right then.
Yes, well, and that's actually what most people did.
Well, right, but there were three or four of these guys who stood up and talked, and they did it because they had told Ron that they would do that before he left.
So he had a tremendous degree of respect from the people who knew him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously you're going to rub some people wrong, but Ron had a lot of respect with people. He was kind of a natural leader. He didn't really want to lead. It was a funny thing, you know. He didn't. I tried to get him to do some social leadership, but he felt that being a reporter was, plenty.
Mm-hmm. So, you would say that Ron, you know, your brother was the kind of guy who had always been willing, when he was a kid, to take point. He'd always been willing to see that the right thing was done.
No, I think that really came to him when he was like 14 or 15. I think that before that he had, your typical childhood, and that, that it was, he was a natural leader, but I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that he had this huge, white hat on his whole life. He put on that white hat when it came time, you know. He didn't have some conviction that he was wearing a white hat until, you know, probably after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
He was really, you know, not, it's probably has more to do with the fact, the type of person he was, and having the military act like he was helpless, we were helpless, the world, it was going to be like they wanted it, and that was the end of it, and, you know, you can cry and scream, but nobody's listening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was pretty upsetting to him to basically be treated as irrelevant because they were confident that there wasn't anything that could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you have... Colin Powell was the information officer for the division when the My Lai thing came down. He got a lot of credibility in that deal. I mean, you might say, and I mean, he may say, that his career really started at that point in terms of, you know, catching the attention of the Pentagon. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, that's... Let's face it, being an information officer at a unit in Vietnam is not exactly, you know, a stepping stone to leadership of the military. You wouldn't think.
And this, actually, you said that when he seemed to change to you, it was when he was 14 or 15. Was that during the time when he had, the stepfather had asked him to leave school?
Well, I think it specifically involved a kind of intense study that he did of history. I think it was like a semester, a teacher I think he had when he was 14, made a fairly exhaustive project in the class of what the Nazis had done. And he read Anne Frank's diary, and he read you know, a number of other things like that. And it seemed to, you know, really impact him. He seemed to be, you know, to develop an opinion. I guess would be what you call it.
Sort of awakened him?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, he just, it was horrifying. I mean, to understand what the Nazis were about, it was horrifying. And he, I think, was horrified by it. And, you know, it didn't really make a difference until he was in Vietnam and got to see what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this polarization against the Nazi mentality was a real... I mean, it really made it obvious to him as a young man that that's, you know, was undeniably what was going on here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that this was a Nazi ploy, that this was what the Nazis did. It was what we had grew up hating. And, you know, I mean, perhaps his history is a little incomplete if he really thought that. But I think that the idealism that most of us went to graduate from high school with and was intact. And he, you know, he just was blown away by the fact that, you know, we were being the Nazis over there. And, you know, I mean, we were, you know, basically when you murder a whole village because you want to send a message, that's Nazi. You know, that's what, I mean, maybe it's not Nazi, maybe it's just military. I don't know. But for us, it was Nazism.
It's wrong.
It's wrong, yeah. It's wrong, and it's what, you know, we hung those guys at Nuremberg for. And, you know, it wasn't really a dispute about it being wrong. And, you know, I mean, it was really not, a lot of people tried to make it seem like Ron was, you know, profiteering or just in it to be famous or, you know, just wanted to make a name for himself. Well, I think those people, you know, haven't used their brain very much because if they used their brain, they'd realize that you don't get any advantage by doing things like that. You know, you basically put your life on hold and become a captive of, you know, an interested public. And Ron's life changed. He did not become the person that he, you know, that I expected him to be. He became somebody else. He became a famous investigative reporter. He lived his life looking over his shoulder. He never really made any money to speak of.
You'd say that this was not the path to fame and fortune. Maybe fame, but not fortune.
No, no fortune at all.
And he didn't expect that.
And the fame was mostly fame amongst the discontent. You know, it wasn't a fame that you could walk into a restaurant and get applause.
None of that, huh?
None of that, no. And, you know, but I would constantly, and for years, until I did change my name in 1997, I would constantly get inquiries from people who wanted to know about Ron and if he was still around, what he was doing. I mean, it was really quite surprising how famous he was. I wouldn't have expected to remember his name 20 years later, you know, or 25 years later. But it wasn't a comment at all.
Well, but what he did certainly did change American history and American policy in Vietnam. Because you can see after that, people's attitudes about the wars, the information started to come out and details about what had happened at My Lai changed radically. Because it was so horrific. I mean, even though there weren't any pictures, there weren't the movies, but even if you go and you read the letter that he wrote, which is up online, at
Melinda, there were pictures. There were pictures. There were lots of pictures.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, it turned out that that unit had a staff photographer, an assigned photographer, you know, like for the Army Times, assigned to it. And he took lots of pictures. But not only did he take lots of pictures, he took one with his, he took pictures with his personal camera. Which is, you know, where they all came from. Because after, you know, when the thing started, when it hit big, you know, when the news came out, he dialed up Life magazine and said, "Hey guys, you know what I've got?" And, of course, they said, "Well, not at all." And so he told them. And later on, an issue of Life came out with all kinds of pictures of people in ditches, lying all over the roads, etc.
And
yeah.
Now that you, yes, and I'm sure that that sent shockwaves across America, because I think until that point, people were denying that it had happened or were saying that it was highly exaggerated. And that it had really truly been a military operation, and that the targets had only been military.
Well,
does that reflect what you remember?
That's what I remember, and that's what they told the guys in the field. There were no, you know, civilian targets there. They were all combatants. You know, the little kids, the little girls and boys, and the toothless old men and women. And the pregnant women, you know, they were all combatants. And it's hard to, but I mean, the thing is that the demonization of a population is such a profound impact on people's psyches that they could go into a village like that, good American boys, and, you know, kill everybody and then, you know, eat lunch. And then go through the bodies, making sure they were all dead, you know, firing rounds into the bodies after lunch.
And that is what happened. They ate lunch and then went through and made sure everybody was dead.
Well, they weren't entirely successful, but yes, they did. They did. And Ron wrote about that. And, you know, it's a grim thing, but I mean, the part about it that is instructive for us today is for people to realize that this is not something that can't happen here. It's not something that requires some, you know, special person who's, you know, raised in a cage and, you know, is a beat every day. It doesn't require that kind of person at all. It requires normal people who have flipped the switch and who can say, you know, this is my job. I'm a soldier. This is what I do. And then they're going to go home and act like they were just in the war. You know, well, of course, that's a joke because none of those people come back and act like they're in the war. They have nightmares. They have trauma. You don't go around killing people, even if that's your job, and not be horribly impacted.
And, well, actually, this has ramifications today because this generation that's fighting the war in Iraq, I think, sort of had the idea that the things that are happening over there, you know, don't have any parallels. But clearly, this sort of operation has happened during the Vietnam conflict, and it's happening over in Iraq. So there are a lot of parallels.
Well, absolutely. You know, only recently, a couple of years ago, I met a guy who was, he must be in his 76 or 75, something like that. I don't know, because he's using a fake ID that makes him about 10 years younger, because he's an ex-NSA guy. He said that he had gone to Vietnam in 1957 as a forward observer, a secret observer, him and four other guys. Been dropped in there. They had backpacked around the hills and everything for months, making maps and you know, doing intel. And when they got back to the United States, they were debriefed by three men, General Haig and General Westmoreland and another guy. And they just told them that it didn't matter what they said, they were going to go to Vietnam. you know, but the intel was irrelevant.
Well, so you're saying that before they even we even really went to Vietnam, they had information telling them that this was a bad idea, and they did it anyway and ignored the advice.
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely a parallel to Vietnam. They knew that there was, you know, they knew what was going on in Vietnam. They knew that the people were not a threat to anybody. They knew that that what was going on there had very little to do with communism and everything to do with Vietnam and French, you know, and it had nothing to do with communism other than they were giving them money, you know, because we wouldn't. And
And
they wanted it.
And so you have all of these deep parallels. And in actual fact, a tremendous amount of money, of course, is being spent in on to contractors in Iraq. And it's the same contractors that were receiving money in Vietnam. Isn't that correct? One of those is actually Halliburton. Halliburton was in Vietnam.
Well, you know, Halliburton is anywhere there's oil, and they weren't doing all the stuff they're doing now in Vietnam, but, yeah, they definitely were doing what they could. I mean, I don't think it was the same. They weren't anything close to the defense contractor they are today.
Hmm. How did all of this change Ron? I mean, he became an investigative journalist because he had gone through this. Had that been the sort of thing he had ever thought about doing before?
I think that he was interested in journalism. I think that he'd gotten interested in journalism probably in the sixth grade. He had a lot of teachers who liked him and encouraged him. And he was a good writer. So I think that he would have been a journalist. I doubt that he would have been an investigative journalist without this. Although, you know, he definitely had that quality to defend people. But the kind of investigative journalism that he pursued was somewhat structured by the fact that after he had come out on this My Lai thing, he really had a name and a reputation that was driving his life from then on.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like Ron just wanted to make other to do something else. When he went to Vietnam and he came back, it was not like he was thinking about doing something else. He came back, he was going to, you know, write that letter. You know, and that's what he did.
So that sort of gave his life a focus. And he followed that. So he could say for the rest of his life.
Well, like most people who are highly accomplished, it seems to almost happen by accident as they, you know, put their passions into that which is in front of them. And their ability makes them successful, and their success pulls them forward.
So it's not like
that's what he was.
To do, and they go do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
They follow the line that was laid out for them.
Right. Well, Ron had the ability to do whatever he wanted in life. He was a natural leader, very well spoken. I know that he probably would have been gone into law. If he hadn't gotten drafted, because that he had that kind of a, you know, intelligence, and he would have been a great lawyer, and who knows where it would have gone. You know, that's the tragedy so much of the Vietnam thing, was the incredibly talented people whose lives were diverted into, you know, basically conflict, and for no real reason. And, you know, Melinda, I have to believe that the people in charge of this country, the people who tell people like Alexander Haig and Westmoreland what to do when they're young men, that they're people who decided that this country needed a war, it needed to basically take this generation and put it through the meat grinder. And, you know, when Vietnam was almost over, they had complete control. The CIA had complete control of Saigon. You couldn't do anything in Saigon without having people come to the CIA about it. Well, it's hard for anybody who was there to believe that in less than 2 weeks you could have every drug available being sold on street corners throughout Saigon. You know, that
was going on.
Well, it happened. It just happened overnight. Somebody made a decision that this needed to happen. It was under George Bush's watch, of course. George H.W. Bush and the CIA.
So that was when he was the head of the CIA. Well, that's
well, he was certainly in Vietnam doing, yeah. I mean, he was in charge of that operation. I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, we've got pictures now of George Bush standing, talking to people in front of the Murrah, the book building in Dallas, right?
Mm-hmm.
He claims that he was never there. But you can find these pictures on the internet, and you know, there's no refutation of them. These are pictures that came out of foreign intelligence agencies, and they show George Bush looking very distinctive in the background. You know, just standing there talking to a group of men. He's the only one who's not looking at the door, waiting for a word to come out about Oswald. He's not curious.
Interesting. Well,
it is.
You've had a life too. You've done a lot of other things. And I'm sure, did this impact you? Did it impact your direction in life because this happened to your brother?
Well, it did. There are two things about it. One, it made me believe that you can, as an individual, make choices and take stands that will make a difference. And that was clear. And I think anybody who knows Ron's story understands that this was not about just anybody, and it wasn't, about, you know, him being in the right spot at the right time. These were choices that he made and defended and, stood up for. And that's what made all the difference. And that's why those guys, from Vietnam would stand up behind Ron, is because he was able to do that, and they trusted that he could do that, that he wouldn't back down, and that he wouldn't be intimidated. You know, Amira Gorey, who doesn't write now, hasn't written for quite a few years, but was a regular in Washington, D.C. during that time, wrote a nice article about Ron after he had testified before Congress. And basically, the text of the article was about how Ron had not backed down, that when the senators had tried to intimidate him, he got back in their face and defied them and insisted that they were the ones who, didn't know what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the guys in Vietnam, got behind him. And, when they came and said, did this happen? They said yes.
Because they knew he would be there for them and he'd stand behind them.
They knew that he wouldn't be intimidated.
Yes.
You know, and, it's hard to say what they knew. But that's one thing you know about guys.
Yeah,
you have a sense of the grit, and Ron had that.
Ron moved to New Orleans. What year? What year was that?
I think it was 89.
So he lived there.
Yeah, it must have been 89. Yeah, something like that.
And he did several journalistic projects that were investigative. While he was living in New Orleans, isn't that right?
It wasn't 89. It was, I'm trying to remember, it was 79.
79?
What am I thinking? 79, yeah.
So that was, he sort of made it his hometown.
He lived there for the rest of his life, basically, huh?
And he really loved New Orleans, right?
Yeah, he did love New Orleans. Had a kind of deep charm. You know, it had an old culture. It had, a kind of a sloth. It had a kind of an old oligarchy running it, just like, you'd expect in an old French colonial city.
And that, I'm sure that was one of the attractions.
Well, he seemed to like that kind of, I mean, he didn't, he kind of enjoyed tweaking them, and he did a good job of that in New Orleans.
What do you think would have happened if Ron had still been alive and the Katrina disaster had happened? What would he have done about it?
Well, that's a very hard thing to say because, you know, Ron was a very, very, he had an amazing ability as a writer to take a very complex issue, an issue that would be, you know, almost too complex for people to comprehend, and make it comprehensible and make people feel passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... if Ron had not died in May of 1998, things would have been different in New Orleans, in a sense that New Orleans would have had more of a voice than it had, because he was a strong voice, and he was one of the people that when people had a thorny issue, that they would go and find. They would go find Ron Ridenour.
So he had become that sort of resource, and certainly there had been a lot of cautionary notes about what was not happening with the levees in New Orleans. So you think that something would have happened about that, and that people would have been aware, and that perhaps what happened with Katrina would not have happened.
That's right. I feel like... what happened with Katrina was not a one-day thing. It was, you know, a kind of a string of mistakes and abuses. And, you know, trying to find the one thing that did it. I mean, I see a lot of people who claim that it was, the levee was blown. Well, you know, hard to find out. When people who are investigating are the ones who are doing things, it's hard to tell.
Yes, it definitely is. Well, you know, it's about time for us to close, Dane. I want to thank you for being with us and sharing some of the memories and the insights. It is so sad that our world lost Ron, especially when they did. And you're doing a project, and it's directed toward New Orleans, and it's a website that's looking at creating virtual neighborhoods so that the people who aren't being allowed to return can at least have that sense of connection to their the world that they knew in New Orleans. Isn't that right?
That's right. We're having our project is fairly simple. We've been trying to identify the most important thing that we can do. It's hard since we're not in New Orleans. I live in Tempe, Arizona, where Ron's from, and really don't have any resources in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have been seeking in New Orleans is people on the ground who would like help.
So how can people get a hold of you so they can help with this project, briefly? Can you give us an email, a phone number?
They can send email to Dane.
D-A-N-E.
D-A-N-E at neighborhoodnode.com.
At neighborhoodnode.com.
That's right.
And also, it takes money to put these together, so if I'm going to ask everybody out there who's been touched by the story and wants to see Ron Ridenour's legacy continue to send a check. And you can get the information on where to send it from Dane at neighborhoodnode.com. Thank you.
Well, that's true.
Thank you, Dane. Thank you so much for being with us. And that's our show for today.
Thank you, Melinda.
Thanks.
I appreciate the time to tell people.
And we appreciate you. And
thanks.
And that's Good Friday, April 14th, 2006. Thank you, Dane, and thank all the rest of you for being with us today. As we begin a process, we hope helps America understand that government is a tool, at times complex, at times simple, just a tool through which we act. If you have suggestions for our show, please contact us and share them online or by phone. We also accept snail mail, and that address is available on our website. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Sometimes, remove to action, because the dictates of conscience make any other course impossible to contemplate, the truth owes a debt to Ron Ridenour that all of us can learn from. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless you on this Good Friday, and may God be with all of us. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.